Welcome to the Mentores Project podcast, covering mentorship, books, and more. In this podcast, we interview the authors of a new series of books where we meet the men and women who mentored Western civilization. This is Dr. Roseanne Welch. For more information, visit mentoresproject.org. Our guest today is Peter Myers, author of Dark Labyrinth, a novel based on the life of Galileo Galilei, the Italian astronomer, physicist, and engineer who is perhaps best known for his championing the radical idea that the sun, not the earth, was the center of the universe, an idea that put him at odds with the Catholic Church for the rest of his life. Thanks for joining us today, Peter.
You're very welcome. Good to be here.
So I'm going to start with my first question, which is always, I think, what's most interesting to our listeners, which is, why do you think Galileo matters to us today?
I think the answer to your question is the same as, why does science matter today? It's like, it's a given.
And of course, he's the father, if you will, of the scientific process, correct?
Yes.
And what exactly did that mean to him? How did he come upon that?
Well, what it meant to him was empiricism, meaning you don't state a theory unless you have empirical data to back up the theory.
I remember watching my son be taught that in fourth grade and thinking about how far back that idea went.
Yeah, goes back. Really, Da Vinci and Galileo were the first two guys to come along to say, I believe what I see and hear and nothing else.
That's one of the reasons that they were considered brilliant, I imagine.
Yeah, because prior to them coming on the scene, scholars and what were known then as philosophers would just read a lot of books and make up their minds about what was real. And neither Da Vinci nor Galileo believed in just reading books. Although they did read books, but they didn't believe that just reading books and giving an opinion on what other people had thought was a really ultimately valid occupation.
So from the very beginning, Galileo was essentially going against the norm and the status quo, correct?
Yes.
So did you have to come up with reasons that something in his childhood created that personality?
No, I didn't approach it from a psychological standpoint. And indeed, I only started the novel when he was well into his career as a teacher.
Fascinating. Because is there just not enough research about what his childhood might have been like?
No, not necessarily. But the most interesting part of his life was where he became a shooting star across the face of Europe, and then basically threatened all these guys with their fat, cushy jobs who had made careers out of just spouting words of the ancient philosophers.
So who among his peers was he debating with, dealing with, in some way helped spark the ideas that he was coming up with?
There were just various scholars. He liked to go to parties because he found, they were called salons in those days, because he would find patrons at these salons, and he would always have interesting discussions, and he really got a kick out of obliterating people in informal debates.
And those are the kind of things that would be held at these salons.
Yes.
An amazing concept. Doesn't sound like the kind of partying we hear about today.
No.
In these events, in these salons, what were the real burning questions that they were all debating?
Well, he actually was a follower of Copernicus and Kepler, two great astronomers who didn't have the proof that they knew was out there. They didn't have a way. They didn't have the telescope, basically. If they'd had what he improved on, they would have beat him to the punch. But they had an inkling from their mathematical calculations, anyway, that the Earth did revolve around the sun, contrarily, according to the Catholic Church. That was the burning question in his mind. How can I prove this? But then, of course, when he saw what he saw, it solidified his reasoning that the Earth revolves around the sun, not vice versa.
It always sounds odd when someone says a phrase like that, and we all go, well, of course, and can't hardly imagine that there was a time when that was a radical idea.
Yeah, it's like the Flat Earth Society, you know?
Exactly, exactly. I can't imagine. And then when you know something so truly, that the discouragement that so many other people didn't listen to you must have been very daunting for him.
It was, and it tortured him the second half of his life.
Wow, that's so sad, all the time to think about. And yet today, of course, we consider him this brilliant man, and if only he lived to know that.
Yeah, yeah.
What would you say was your impression of Galileo before you started to do this research and get involved in the book?
I didn't know anything about the man, other than that he had discovered that the Earth revolved around the sun. That was the extent of my knowledge of Galileo. In that sense, I knew less about Galileo than I knew about Da Vinci before I started the Da Vinci novel.
What made you choose him?
I was hired to write the novel.
There you go. But that's pretty much everyone's story.
I turned in the Da Vinci novel in a meeting with Robert Barbera, the head of the Enteris Project, and he was on the phone when I walked into his office, and I came in, sat down, and I put a 300-odd page manuscript of my Da Vinci novel on his desk, and he handed me a slip of paper, and on the slip of paper, it said, "Your next assignment is Galileo."
You thought?
Well, I was excited, you know? I mean, the thought of writing a novel about Galileo was exciting to me.
So that makes me ask, in the course of researching his life, what would you say was your favorite fact or interesting moment in his life? What was the thing you discovered that you hadn't known before? Of course, we didn't know a lot about him, as you said. But what was the thing you wanted to make sure you included in the story because it was so defining of the man?
The whole interlude where he goes to visit a cardinal, it was a particular cardinal who was very high up in the church. And what he was responsible for was deciding whether something was heretical or not.
Ah.
He was like an opinion leader in the church hierarchy. Very well respected. And he was known, that his nickname was the Hammer of Heretics.
Okay.
And this Hammer of Heretics decided to have a meeting because things were kind of coming to a head. Because Galileo was constantly hounding the clergy, various cardinals who he had befriended, most notably at these salons.
Of course.
The cardinals also liked to party. He decided, okay, we're going to call Galileo here and we're going to have it out with him and decide what we're going to do about him. Are we going to censure him? Are we going to excommunicate him? Are we going to tell him he can't write anything anymore about these scientific matters? What are we going to do with them? And essentially, the group consisted of people kind of middle of the roaders and people on one side, extremely so, and people on another side, extremely so, because Galileo had a lot of priests and cardinals who totally respected him as a scholar and a scientist. And when he wrote a book, it was called The Starry Messenger. When he wrote that book in 1609, divulging his discoveries, it caused it was an earth-shaking event in science. And the book went all across Europe. Kings were reading it. Cardinals were reading it. Scientists, other astronomers were reading it. And it was just earth-shaking. Here he is in this meeting, and it was kind of a milestone in his life, because he walked in and they were essentially opposed against him. There was one particular cardinal who was very much against Galileo and his ideas. The cardinal whose house it was, who's the Hammer of Heretics, he had been mandated to call the meeting by the Pope at the time. Basically, they were trying to bring Galileo in line with their dogma. And the Pope had said, get into your house and have it out with them, et cetera, et cetera. And the Pope laid out the rule or the stricture as to how Galileo should proceed here on out. And it was basically, don't put in writing your ideas about the Earth revolving around the sun, and continue to do that, then we'll have to move on to other actions. This other cardinal added in certain words that made it even stricter, and it was his own ideas. It wasn't the Pope's.
Ah.
And this other cardinal went so far as to phony up a document and put it in Leonardo's file that he had received this stricture, right? Mm-hmm. And it was found years later, and it was found that it was never signed, which all these strictures had to be signed.
To prove they'd been received by the person.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that it had been an official document of the church. So that guy was a phony. Later on, when it came to the attention of the Inquisition that Galileo was not following this additional stricture that this guy made up, they decided to investigate him. And that's when the shit hit the fan, and he was called up before the Inquisition. So the whole thing was predicated on this phony document.
And you discovered that in the course of your research through some excellent academic work, or how did you find that?
I wound up reading about 50 books. That's 50 books. Yes. On Galileo. And so by the end of that research period, I was a little mini Galileo expert.
That's wonderful. What a great person to know so much about.
Yeah.
So let me ask you, in discovering so much about him, what would you think was in your own background that allowed you to connect with him, to really be able to write about him and get into his headspace, as we say?
Well, I'm a writer. And before I was a writer, I was a sculptor. And before I was a sculptor, I was a writer. And I think my research abilities started off in junior high school. I had a history teacher who gave us an assignment every week saying, find out this, what was the law that was created in 1862 or 1837 or whatever that did blah, blah, blah. And we'd have to go off into the libraries and figure this out, or right. who wrote the law or whatever, any historical incident. And that's what got me into being able to research.
Fascinating that it started so young. So many people don't have that opportunity.
Yeah. So I enjoyed that a lot. And then in high school, I continued that. And then at the University of California at Santa Cruz, I still continued in research. UC Santa Cruz had this interesting system. You didn't get grades. It was pass fail. And then what the teacher would do is he would write an evaluation of you in addition to either passing or failing on a course. And I remember getting stellar comments from all the professors and assistant professors. And one comment stuck out in that was something like, he has a scholarly mind or something. And as a screenwriter, many times I was picking things to write screenplays about that were based on real life and had to do research. So my whole life has really, starting about the age of 12, has included research. That's how I'm kind of predisposed to writing a book about Galileo.
But that's perfect. And it is a skill that so many people don't really take the time to obtain. And it is so useful, not even just in the writing world, but in our own world, to understand what's going on around us and all of that. I think it's very useful.
Yeah.
How cool. What aspect of him do you think was most important, right? We know he's an astronomer. We know that he's got all these other talents. How did he make his living? How do you make a living as an astronomer?
He had different sources of income. When I start the novel, he's a teacher at the University of Padua, which is part of the Venetian Republic. So as such, they were not under the domination of the Inquisition. So he write that book the Starry Messenger without having to get okayed by the Inquisition. He took full advantage of that. See, what he did is there was a guy named Lippershey, and he created the first telescope. His viewpoint on it was a child's toy. And he could look at his neighbor's barn and see his neighbor's barn magnified. And Galileo said, I'm not interested in seeing my neighbor's barn. I want to see the world. What he did is improve on what the Dutchman had created. His first attack on it was double the magnification. The ratio was 3-1 on Lippershey's telescope, and Galileo's was 6-1. And then shortly thereafter, he increased it again, and it was magnifying things 8 times bigger. And he kept going. And finally, he was up to 20x magnification.
Wow.
Yeah. He might have gone further, I can't remember, but at least 20 times. And that allowed, even at doubling Lippershey's magnification power, allowed him to see the Milky Way, which completely blew his mind, because the Milky Way was known about and was visible in the night sky for hundreds or thousands of years. I think even going back to Babylon, it was known about. But it was just a glow in the night sky. It was a dot. And when he trained his 6X telescope on it, it was an explosion of stars. And he realized he was looking right into the center of, well, he thought he was looking into the center of the universe. He didn't realize there were galaxies beyond ours. Even so, it was extremely dramatic for him. And he prayed to God and thanked God for giving him the ability to create the telescope to be able to see what he saw. And it was just completely revolutionary. No one had ever seen the Milky Way and at that magnification on Earth. First man to do it.
Then how did he share that with other people? Did they come and use the telescope? Did he bring it to places to show important people? How was he able to spread that information besides writing? I mean, you want to look at it.
Well, he hired assistants to make more of them. And the Doge of Venice, he did a demonstration for the Doge of Venice, which is an interesting sidelight in the novel. And he meets him in the ground floor of this church. And then they go up to the tower, which is 100, 200 feet in the air or whatever. And they have, the Doge is an old guy, so they have to carry him up this winding stairway, right? Galileo is on his own. He's got to trudge along behind. And he finally gets to the top, you know, 10, 15, 20 stories. I don't know how tall it is. But it's very cool. And he sets up his telescope, and he explains the concept to the Doge and says, this will allow anybody to look through the telescope and see a ship that's too far for the naked eye to see, but is headed toward our port. So he looks through the telescope and he looks around and he sees a particular ship and describes it and says, it'll be here in a couple hours and no one can see it. And it's not real to the Doge how the hell this could be.
Right.
But finally, the Italians, they love to party and they love to drink wine. And so they wait a couple hours and they're partying, drinking wine and everything. Then Galileo looks through the scope again and he sees the ship and it's much closer and starts describing it and everything. And then somebody in the crowd says, yes, I can see it. It's there. It's arrived. And the Doge looks through the telescope and he sees this big ship. Whereas the guy that saw the ship with the naked eye, he can only see a little tiny thing in the far distance. So it blows the Doge's mind and he immediately realizes the military value of being able to get the drop on the enemy by seeing what they're doing long before they're close enough to present any threat. And they order one and they pay him good money for it. So that was one source of his income. And then he had a certain yearly income from his teaching position, his professor. And what they did is they said, you can focus on your science and you don't have to teach, and we're going to pay you this salary every year. And they did that because they considered him one of the stars of the astronomical world, right?
Sure. It was like a research institution, and he was getting paid to do research more than to teach.
Yeah. Yeah. And then he had another source of income. He rented out some rooms in his house to students in Padua University. So there's three sources right there. But he was constantly needing money. He had two daughters, a nephew, his mistress. Those are the people he was taking care of. So the money was coming in, going out as soon as it came in. And he was just always stressed out on finance matters.
Makes sense. Yeah. So the way you described the scene going with the tower, I'm going to guess that was your favorite scene that you wrote? Or is there one that you had to make up to create a bridge between two moments in his life? What scene did you enjoy the most creating?
I would say, and this is a true life scene, nothing that I made up, the Inquisition was like a trial, and the results of the trial were the sentencing. And the day of the sentencing, he came in, and his enemies are all around him in the room. They're all waiting to gloat on his defeat, because in those days, there was no boundary between religion and science. There are certain things in the Bible that can be considered to be scientific statements. And this is what the big deal was Galileo was saying, no, science and religion are two different things. And the people who wrote the Bible certainly granted man the ability to reason and come up with scientific conclusions on his own. And this is not the proper portfolio, so to speak, of the Bible. The proper portfolio of the Bible is to talk about God and the salvation of the spirit. And sciences should be left to the scientists. And that was his big thing. So this particular judgment against him was harsh in that they didn't excommunicate him. They didn't burn him at the stake, but they put him under house arrest, and they mandated that he couldn't write or teach to students his ideas. So it was completely shutting him down as a scientist and a teacher, and completely shutting him down as far as freedom of movement. He couldn't leave his home. And they actually, the Inquisition had guys watching his house to make sure they didn't leave his home. This is just really, really oppressive.
Yes. And how many years are we talking about?
The last 11 years of his life. So that was a particularly heavy moment. And they made him go back on his scientific beliefs as part of the judgment.
Renounce them.
Yeah, he had to renounce the whole thing verbally. And they told him what he had to say. Talk about sticking in his craw. And there was a apocryphal statement that he was said to have made after that was all over. They were still in the room, right? And it's over and they're getting ready to leave. And some author somewhere said, at the end, Galileo said, and yet it moves, meaning around the sun, you know?
Right.
But that never happened. But I'm sure he may have thought that. But, you know, this is a guy who realized at the end of the whole process that they could have easily killed him. Around the turn of the century, somewhere around 1600, a guy named Giordano Bruno had been burned at the stake. It was 9 years before Galileo invented his telescope, or not invented, but improved on the existing one. So that was always in the background. And Bruno had been burned at the stake because he had crazy ideas that he would not give up, wouldn't, he can't. And they finally got fed up with him and burned him to a crisp.
Wow. So, I mean, clearly Galileo knew what was at stake, no pun intended, but what the danger was. And so that makes sense that he would have renounced his idea, no matter how that would have made him feel, obviously, in order to stay alive and keep doing his science and doing his studying.
Yeah, exactly.
Always I'm looking for what theme or themes did you find running through his life? Or if you didn't find any cohesive ones, which ones did you use to build your story?
The overarching theme is the desire to say the truth, no matter what anybody thinks. And it's a struggle to do that in the face of incredible opposition, including, now this guy was old. He was in his 60s when the Inquisition decided to have it out with him, right?
Right.
In that age, people didn't usually live till their 60s. They died in their 30s. The lifespan was just short compared to what it is now. During the Inquisition trial, he was actually threatened with torture. His contemporaries wrote about this. They actually threatened Galileo with torture. If they torture him, he won't survive.
At that age, of course.
Yeah. So here's a guy who's being threatened with torture, and it's the ultimate test of integrity. Because there's plenty of people in world history who did die, who refused to give in and recant their beliefs, and were killed because of it. He was a guy who backed down when it came to, you know, life or death.
I can totally understand that, and better that he's around to continue learning and passing the idea along, clearly.
Yeah, but keep in mind, he couldn't really pass his ideas along.
He was prevented from that. But I'm sure, with men, as with many things, people who believed in him obviously kept the idea going until the modern day.
Yeah. Well, what was happening during his life was his books were getting published in other European countries where Catholic Church didn't have as much power or any power. This was during the Reformation, which had begun not much earlier with Martin Luther or something. The Catholic Church had created the Counter-Reformation and just got stricter about forcing people to believe what they wanted them to believe.
Sure, because they saw them disappearing in all these other different versions of Christianity, and they were scared of losing their following.
Absolutely. It was a very political thing for the Catholic Church.
So, because, of course, one of the things that is of most importance to the Mentors Project is the concept of mentoring, my second to the last question is, who would you say were Galileo's mentors?
Kepler and Copernicus, until he surpassed them. And there was correspondence between Galileo and Kepler in particular. I think Copernicus predated Galileo, but Kepler was around. And Kepler, in one of his letters, fully realized that he had been passed by Galileo. He'd been surpassed.
Wow.
And he stated it in a letter.
That's the ultimate compliment, when your mentor tells you that you've gone beyond their understanding.
Yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, then my actual last question is always, who would you say are your mentors?
The name Thomas Jefferson comes to mind. But in terms of, you know, me as a writer and who I depend on, who I go to for problems about writing, I don't really have any. Because as a writer, you've got to make a personal statement. And you can't be listening to what anybody else tells you.
That's true. That's what we define as voice. You have to have your voice.
Yeah.
Well, with that, I must say thank you so much for sitting with us today. It was very interesting to hear all about Galileo, and I'm excited to have more people get the book when it opens up on June 1st. Thank you for coming. Thanks for listening to the Mentors Podcast, sponsored by the Barbera Foundation, whose mission is to promote positive change by inspiring others to engage in their community. Your host has been Dr. Roseanne Welch. Our music was composed by Patrick Abate, technical direction by Douglas E. Welch, and Kathleen Childress designed our website. For more information and to read more about the great mentors in history, visit mentorsproject.org and join us for our next conversation.